All right. Well, we got through communion, so we can relax now, right? Or maybe I can. Maybe I'm the only one who's a little uptight this morning. It's been a minute since I was up here to speak to you guys all by myself. Last time I was up here was with Heather, and that was a super great experience. But yeah, I'm excited to be here again this morning and get to talk to you about Romans. If you don't know, Pastor Ryan this morning is just finishing up a half marathon. It's funny because we're essentially the same age, and I'm like, no thanks. You do you, buddy. No, it's awesome. I'm excited for him, and I can't wait to hear stories of how that went this morning and find out if his time was better than mine from 10 years ago, so we'll see. We're not competitive. I wanted to tell you this morning that I, from the time I was a very young kid, have been a fan of magazines. So back in the 1900s when I grew up, any of you else with me? You know we're in the 2000s now, so we can say that. Sometimes the best source of information about a hobby or an industry that you were interested in was through a magazine. And so my dad had this collection of off-road and automotive magazines. And so as a pretty young kid, I just loved looking through those. You know, he built a pickup truck for the dunes when I was in, well, before I was born. And so he had all of these off-road magazines that showed big jacked up trucks and big motors and all of that kind of stuff. And so that really sparked in me this desire to find out more information about things I was interested in. And that's when I discovered that I loved fast cars and especially fast motorcycles. And so that started me getting my own subscriptions to magazines later on in my life. One of my favorites was Auto Week. Anybody ever read Auto Week? Yeah, a few of you, yeah. So it would come weekly, which was fantastic because most magazines were, you know, a monthly kind of thing. And it was all the information about, you know, what was going on in the automotive world. But at the very end of the magazine, there was this little section called, "But Wait, There's More." And here's an example of that. And it was like the editor's last little shot to say, hey, here's some entertainment or some interesting information for you. My favorite ones were often the absurdly ridiculous, because that's what But Wait, There's More is all about. It was just by the one that you can see here, a woman flipping the bird and flipping her car over. But it was like this, so if it was really amusing or if it was really outrageous, those were my favorite versions to read. What I didn't know was that this whole concept wasn't a new thing, right? It was my first real understanding of, but wait, there's more. Do you guys know where else you might have heard that phrase? Infomercials, that's right, yes. Kind of popularized through those. But it wasn't a new concept, okay? So it's this idea called amplification, right? It's where you don't want to give your best argument to start things off. So it was like, as a magazine, they were saying, well, maybe we did a good job and you were entertained, or maybe we did a good job and you were informed, or maybe we didn't. But either way, they could take one more shot at you at the very end of the magazine to say, oh, but check this out, and maybe we would change the whole vibe of the magazine before you ditched it. Or you'd be like, man, that was the best issue ever, right? If that page was particularly good. So this idea of amplification goes back even further than that. I went down this whole rabbit hole the last couple weeks. You guys are going to enjoy this very much, I promise. You're already like, nah, not really. But this actually comes from a concept from ancient Greece and Rome that's called Dirimens Copulatio, which is amplification or turning up the volume on your argument or offer as you proceed with your case. So if you're in an argument with someone, you're not going to lead with your best thing, right? Because then everything you do from there is downhill, right? And so if they come up with better arguments, you're like, shoot, I don't have anything better to give them now. Well, Paul clearly is aware of this concept because he's using it in Romans. You may have heard Pastor Ryan talk about how we've been progressing on this path where Paul is talking about where we are so that we understand who we are, so that when he gets to the Jesus part and says, hey, there has been a shift in reality. We have this clear understanding, and he's building this case, this argument about who we are and what's happening in our world, and then what comes next. So I'm arguing that Paul, especially in chapter 3, is using, but wait, there's more, right? So we're going to look at a couple of things that I think he's using, a couple of arguments that I think he's using this this tactic on. We're in chapter 3, and if you go to YouVersion this morning, you're going to get a treat. You may have noticed last week that the sermon wasn't in there quite yet, but it's been in there all week, and it's still there today. So there are two Genesis Church sermons under events and more. This morning we're on November 10th, called But Wait, There's More. And your luck is good this morning. You can go back and rewatch last week's sermon and follow along with the notes from there too, right? I can tell you're all going to do that. Yes. So we are going to start in Romans chapter 3, starting in verse 21. And this is what Paul has to say to us. But now God has shown us a way to be made right with him without keeping the requirements of the law, as was promised in the writings of Moses and the prophets long ago. We are made right with God by placing our faith in Jesus Christ. And this is true for everyone who believes, no matter who we are. For everyone has sinned. We all fall short of God's glorious standard. Paul's making sure that we are all well aware there is absolutely no way for any individual or any group of people to be right with God apart from Jesus. He has to include verse 23 so that we understand that it is total and final, this proclamation. There is no squeaking in of just being good enough. There's no idea that we've somehow done just enough to deserve to be right with God. There just isn't any option outside of Jesus. And God never intended the law or the rules that we talk about in the Old Testament to be the thing that provides us right relationship with God, or what you might call righteousness. The law was always about showing us people our sin, showing us ways we cannot possibly measure up to the standard of perfection. The law is ultimately hopeless because it gives us no way to change that reality. It gives us nothing that says, you can do this. There's no idea of buying into the system by being good enough or by earning some kind of good credits just by clean living. Paul wants all of us, everyone, to know, Jews, Gentiles, you and I, that in order to buy into God's system of perfection, that we have to adopt Jesus's right living as our own. This is his first, but wait, there's more moment. He's transitioning into the good news. He's saying, we don't meet up to this line, but there is good news because we do. So in Romans 3:24, he says, yet God in his grace freely makes us right in his sight. He did this through Christ Jesus when he freed us from the penalty for our sins. For God presented Jesus as the sacrifice for sin. People are made right with God when they believe that Jesus sacrificed his life, shedding his blood. This sacrifice shows that God was being fair when he held back and did not punish those who sinned in times past. For he was looking ahead and including them in what he would do in this present time. God did this to demonstrate his righteousness, for he himself is fair and just, and he makes sinners right in his sight when they believe in Jesus. So God, through Jesus' life, death, and resurrection, gives us what we can never earn or deserve. It's the love and the grace and the mercy that we so desperately need in our lives and can't seem to handle on our own. He couldn't just sweep sin and destruction and all of the wrong that we had done in our lives under the rug. That wouldn't be just. That wouldn't be his character, right? He can't ignore sin. God cannot tolerate our sin. How could he just sweep it under the rug? Instead, he chose to just solve the problem. Sounds simple, right? Sounds easy. Just solve the problem. Paul's going to make an argument here that God does three things through Jesus so that we are completely fixed, that our hopeless situation doesn't remain hopeless, but it actually fixes us even beyond what we think about when we just look at it on the surface. So the first is this. It's a word called justification. If you read these verses in the NIV, these three words that I'm going to talk about today are actually included there. The version that we use uses slightly different wording, but the concepts are all in there and they're all the same. So justification is when you're acquitted and released. So you are a criminal, right? The first thing that has to happen for you to be acquitted is that you have been charged with a crime. So I was charged with a crime this summer, for those of you who don't know. Not a big one, okay? Don't gasp. It's okay. But for the first time in 19 years, I got a speeding ticket. Some of you are more surprised that it's been 19 years than the fact that I got a speeding ticket. So I deserved it, fully deserved it. I was lost in some residential neighborhood in Scranton, Pennsylvania, and couldn't find the airport. And I was driving down this road, and it was downhill, and I'll make all the excuses. And it was by a park, and there was a police officer sitting at the park, and I was well over the speed limit. So I just pulled over. As soon as I saw him pull out onto the street, I just pulled over because, you know, yeah, that's what you do when you're guilty, right? Right? You just admit it. He was angry. He was very angry with me. Asked if I knew what I'd done. I said, yeah, definitely did. Yep. So he wrote me a ticket as I deserved, and I had to humbly accept that ticket and realize that I needed to pay my punishment. And so I filled out my check and sent it in to the court in Scranton. By the way, who gets a speeding ticket in Scranton, Pennsylvania, you know? I was looking for Dwight. So what would have happened, though, if a couple weeks after I mailed in that check, if I got an envelope in the mail from the court that had my check included in it, and it had a stamp on it that said acquitted, no fine necessary? I tell you, that would have been good news for my bank account. It would have been even better news for my insurance premiums, right? My life would have become a little bit sweeter. Things would have changed for me. Unfortunately, that did not happen. They cashed that check the day they got it. That was it. But that acquittal, that feeling that comes in that moment, that's Jesus. That is Jesus for us. We can't get out of these things that we have done. We have all been speeding in the paths of life, and we are guilty. And God says, but you're not. You're not. Jesus paid that. You are acquitted. Second is redemption. And this is this concept that we are slaves to our sin. Paul uses this visual quite a bit in his writings, right? That sin so thoroughly has its fix on us, it has its hands on us, that we can't get away from it. And so everything we do is affected by it. It's driven by the things that we do wrong in our lives. Except Jesus breaks that bond. He paid the ransom that it took to get us back, to rescue us out of that, to say, hey, you don't have to be a slave to that anymore. That is not the way you have to continue living your life. Jesus releases us from the obligations of our guilt and wrongdoing. And here's the even better part. God, because of that, doesn't just say, all right, cool, you're good now. God actually, in that moment, invites us into his family. It's not that we're just not slaves anymore. Now we are part of the family. You're no longer the prodigal who's like, man, my dad must hate me, and I just want to go back and be a slave. No, you're invited into the family. You've been brought back to be exactly who you were created to be. You're not lowly anymore. You've been elevated. You're honored as a son and daughter, a child of God. That is what Jesus does for us. He justifies us. He calls us acquitted. He redeems us. He sets us free. The third one is a funny word called expiation. And it's you should look this up later. I was tempted to go down a rabbit hole of telling you all about how this all works, but it would be better if you just look this up on your own and check that out, because it really is pretty fascinating about this concept. But it's basically that Jesus took the punishment, and as he bled on the cross for us, it literally washed away our sin. It meant that even though we do commit sin, even though we do the wrong thing, even though we choose to walk away from God and do things the wrong way, we're still right with him when we accept that Jesus took our punishment. We are no longer guilty in the eyes of God because of what Jesus does for us, and only us, right? It's not like Jesus did this for himself. I mean, he came and lived this life and lived this through this death and was raised again by God just because we needed it. I mean, that's incredible. We need to understand these three new realities, because Paul's going to use this to show us there's a lot more life because of what Jesus does for us. We're not guilty. We are rescued. We've been set free from everything that keeps us bound up and keeps us timidly fearful that we have offended or that we're going to continue to offend. There's so much more that we don't have to worry about our bad choices and our sin ruining our lives and other people's lives. I think we forget this sometimes because we go back to that. We think, I'm supposed to be perfect. Well, if you already are, then what difference does it make? If you're already forgiven, why do you have to stress so much about the things that you do? And that's not to say that we don't attempt to do a better job, to stop offending the people around us, to stop living so closely to sin. But what are we afraid of our sin? Are we afraid that God is somehow going to change his mind and no longer forgive us? How could he? He forgave us before we even cared about him. He did all of this knowing that we might reject him anyway and that some people were going to reject him. He did this. He calls us highly favored no matter what we decided about who God was and what Jesus was going to be in our lives. Man, we got a lot less to worry about than we think. We have so much more freedom than we could ever imagine. So let's look at what Paul says. Okay, we're back to another, but wait, there's more. Because Paul says, oh, there's a new reality in light of these three things, right? So verse 27, can we boast then that we have done anything to be accepted by God? No, because our acquittal is not based on obeying the law. It is based on faith. So we are made right with God through faith and not by obeying the law. After all, is God the God of the Jews only? Isn't he also the God of the Gentiles? Of course he is. There is only one God, and he makes people right with himself only by faith, whether they are Jews or Gentiles. Well then, if we emphasize faith, does that mean that we can forget about the law? Of course not. In fact, only when we have faith do we truly fulfill the law. Listen, salvation is done, and it has been freely offered to you by God, by the offended party. All he asks of us is to have a little faith, and a little is the word there. And this offer is for everyone, not just for one particularly special group of people. We're not any more special than anybody else, just like the Jews weren't any more special than anyone else, as Paul says. It is literally for everyone. Whatever you might believe about how someone chooses God or how God chooses us, Jesus makes it known that being right with God is offered to all of us. Some of us want to boast about our connection to God, and Paul says it's a problem for all of us. So what does boasting look like according to Paul? Well, if you look up boasting, a definition of boasting, it is having confidence in the flesh. It's worshiping a creature rather than the creator and savior. The Jews felt like they had a reason to boast because they followed God's Old Testament laws, right? And then they transitioned into following Jesus. So they were doing just all of the things so splendidly, right? Paul says, no, wait a minute, hold on. Problem is that the law, as we've said, has no ability to save us. It helps us to see our sin. It sets us up to understand that God has a standard for our lives, but it doesn't give us any kind of a way to fix that. Every sacrifice that the Jews made was just to cover up their sin after it was done. Jesus doesn't need to just cover it up because he's paid for it. If we've deluded ourselves into thinking that we are somehow choosing Jesus completely on our own, instead of knowing that God chose us for this sacrifice, we've missed the point. You and I believing in Jesus and his work to wipe out our sin isn't what causes our new right condition with God. God's grace and mercy causes us to be right with him. We accept this new reality as truth in our faith. If we aren't causing any of this new reality, how can we be proud of ourselves, right? We have done literally nothing to influence this. We haven't brought about our rightness with God. We're just choosing to accept that God has already done this. Listen, we know each other, right? Are we ever going to get away from boasting about something? Are we? No. I mean, it's so deep in our nature. We have to know the reality of there's something to brag about, right? We always can find something to brag about. I know a lot of people, maybe you know some people, that they will brag about all of the things that they do wrong. Anybody know somebody like that? Yeah, the nervous chuckles. Maybe some of you are raising your hand for yourself. I mean, I just kind of did it, right? I told you about my speeding ticket, made it a joke, you know, that whole thing, right? That's all part of it. But Paul is talking about the difference between boasting in what's good and what's not good. So how do we boast in the things that are not good? I've told you that it's worshiping, or it's worshiping the creator, instead of the creator. But how do we do it, even as Jesus followers? So I think there's a couple of ways. Number one, we overemphasize not loving the world by withdrawing, by stepping away from the world and not being God's ambassadors to a world that's desperately in need of hope and a word of future. We brag about not sinning by excluding ourselves from others, and by not living real life with people who need to see that there's something different about what Jesus is doing inside of us. If we completely separate ourselves from the world, we're saying, I got it, I'm good. Essentially, we raise ourselves up onto a pedestal of better than you. Whether it's by our words or by our action, it doesn't really matter. It's still our attitude. It's our understanding of life. We're saying, I got this together. As Jesus followers, we should be the first to understand about where we need to be boasting instead of in ourselves. You and I, our lives are going to tell a story. And whether that story is about who we are or about who God is inside of us is up to us. Paul says it later in 2 Corinthians, as the scriptures say, if you want to boast, boast only about the Lord. When people commend themselves, it doesn't count for much. The important thing is for the Lord to commend them. All right, so how is God going to commend us? How do we live unboastfully in ourselves? Well, I think our lives, we need to use the story of our lives to brag about God's gifts. And why not? If Jesus did those three things that I talked about, if Jesus sets us free, if Jesus paid for our sin, If Jesus did all of that, why wouldn't we brag about that instead of whatever it is that we're bringing to the table? Because all of that is far, far, far better than anything I could ever accomplish on my own. And I can accomplish some good things, right? Let's be honest, we're talented, special people because of who God created us to be. But God creates something even better in this life and death of Jesus beyond that. Paul's trying to remind us that it is incredible and beautiful what Jesus does. He's trying to help us center our attention on this fact. This is a reminder of the dawn of our faith, as Ryan talked about last week, right? It's the coldest before the dawn. Well, we are at the dawn. Jesus has done the thing. He has rescued us and set us free. Paul says the story of our lives should point to a good God who loved us enough to save us from ourselves. And he's waiting for everyone around us to accept this reality and make it a part of their lives too. I want you to think about it practically, right? Let's say you're poor and struggling and you've got a new toddler at home and you have no prospect of quick economic changes. Your daily transportation is falling apart. You can no longer keep up with repairs or replace it. Then one day a check shows up in the mail, specifically for replacing your busted down hoopty. The thing you could not do for yourself has been provided for you. Amen. It's a blessing, right? It's this gift that's been given to you. So let's say you're driving around in your new car and somebody's like, dang, look at that. Where'd you get that? You're like, oh yeah, I bought that, paid for it. It's all mine, right? No. No, we would tell that story. We would tell that story like, you wouldn't believe what happened to me, right? It is so exciting. It's changed our lives in this way. It's released that daily anxiety of like, is this the day the thing is going to die on the side of the road? That we wouldn't be able to help but talk about it, to live as if that car was something special that had been gifted to us. It's a blessing that restores hope and peace to your everyday life. I've lived that story. Let me tell you that leaving the dealership that day was different, right? It was very different. It was overwhelming. So how much more then our sense of hope and our release of anxiety about our own future because of Jesus? We have safe transport through this messy life because of the sacrifice that Jesus gives us. It only makes sense to give credit where it's due, just like we would with that car. It's our, but wait, there's more moment in our lives. There's so much more amazing life that comes because of what Jesus has freed us to do in the future. Think about it this way, Genesis Church, a community of people deeply impacted by Jesus and so grateful for it that they can't help but spread the message that there is healing and rescue and hope for all people in our neighborhood and outside of our neighborhood. Listen, that is a message and a movement that we can get behind, right? Hope. There's a lot of grumpy, disgruntled, lonely individuals out there looking for peace and hope. And if you have separated yourself from that world, let me tell you, you are needed. And that's what Paul is saying this morning. We can default to pride in ourselves or pride in our idols. It's going to produce arrogance and hatred and hard-heartedness towards others. But what we have to offer others apart from God is not pretty, especially in the eyes of everyone else. You might think you're all right, but let me tell you, others don't think so highly of you. You don't have to carry around a bunch of shame and regret about those decisions, right? Jesus has released you from it. Now it's our turn to tell the truth about our lives to others who are in and out of our lives. You know, we get to live life set free. There's a reason that you are alive today. It's because a good God created you. There's a reason that you are here today. It's because you were forgiven of the wrong you've done, a blameless Jesus died for you. There's a reason you have confidence in the future. Jesus promised that he would always be with us after God resurrected him from the grave. And I recognize that this has been maybe an interesting week for you or a difficult week for you. We have experienced this period of time, maybe a few months, where we've kind of had two idols set up before us who are going to save the world, or at least maybe America. It has been too easy to look at our political gains and losses as formational for our lives. What I believe Paul is trying to tell us, what I believe about our world in light of Jesus, is that now is the best possible time for us to reorient ourselves to the truth of the gospel, that Jesus came and died for us, and he is the only one who can save us. He is the only one who can give us hope for the future. It is not our economic policies. It is not our gender politics. It is not, what was the third one? It is not any of those things, right? It's not the vigor of our political party that sets us free, that saves us. Our hope, our care for all of the people in our neighborhood comes solely from God who saves us. That's it. If we don't get this right, if we don't start taking our role as God's beacons of hope to people around us, we'll be no better than the Jews that Paul is writing to in Rome. Today is the time to live into the confidence that Jesus brings us to in a new or a renewed way. Not confidence in yourself, not confidence in anyone or anything else. Instead, with the hope and the peace and the promise of this incredible gift that Jesus has given us, it's time to use your story to tell, to brag about God's gifts. Your story. You have a story. And it is good for others to hear. It's good for all of us to hear it because our world is crying out for hope right now. Where there's hopelessness, we can reach out and say, but wait, there's confidence in Jesus. Where there's loss and loneliness, we can sit down and practice, but wait, there's joy in the life that comes later. Paul is inviting you today to see the importance of the change that Jesus makes in your life. We need to begin living more fully outward, focused on others who need to hear that same message. It's good to be loud and to boast, but only to be loud and to boast about the sacrifice that Jesus made for our freedom. Will you pray with me? God, we do believe that you are good. Because if you weren't good, we wouldn't have this hope. And there's so much inside of us that sees the hope of you and goes, yeah, that's what I need. And sometimes we forget that the people around us are looking for that same thing too. That our story of meeting you, of understanding the sacrifice that Jesus made for us, man, that's the story of so many other people in our world around us. God, make us less fearful of our sin. You didn't free us to be afraid of the future. You freed us to see the future as this glorious gift that has been given to all of us and to everyone around us. Help us to live that way, free and light and as ambassadors of your hope. In your name we pray, Jesus.